We're in a period now that appears that we're sliding into stagflation. That is just an absolutely awful position to be in. This is abnormal to see stocks ripping to new highs and gold ripping to new highs at the same time. On a $2 trillion deficit, they still have to borrow. And unless they have inflation run to insane levels, they're still going to run in deficit, so they can't let it get out of control. Keep the charade going. Keep the Ponzi going. The question is, how hot will they let inflation run? That's the only question that's in my mind. If you have assets, it's great. If you don't, you're toast. The market, the street has just swallowed hundreds of thousands of OG coins that we know of. And the price didn't really move. We hit 150, 180 by the year end. You know, it wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Good to see you, man. How are you feeling? You feeling bullish? We're over 115K again.
Good to see you, Danny. I mean, I'm always bullish long term. If your horizon is long enough, then you're always bullish in Bitcoin. So
it's funny. Like I've been in this thing too long to panic over this whatever we had 15% dip. But it was crazy to see how many people were panicking about it. And the one thing that does seem pretty clear is this cycle is completely different to anything we've had before. It's been a complete grind. It really hasn't had any of the euphoria sort of dopamine hit of previous cycles. What do you think's happening?
Well, I mean, first of all, people have been frustrated just because they're a little bit fatigued. It's just been a long, grinding, sideways summer, you know? If you start out in the late spring, we were grinding from 100 to 110, and then we ground all the way through until July, and then we started grinding from 110 to 120, and now we're back around 110 now, you know, a few days ago, and people are like, ah, what are we doing? Is it? Have we hit the high? Is this cycle over? You know, like you said, is there no more cycles? Are there no more 4-year cycles? Like, what's happening? And at the same time, you know, you had this, a little bit of euphoria around the Bitcoin treasury companies, and we can talk about that, but got ahead of themselves a little bit, and they pulled back, and people were, you know, getting fatigued about that and voicing their concerns about it. And I think that it's just the summer, you know? I mean, this happened so many years in my career, Danny, where we're just sitting here in the summer. It's like, where is everybody? What is going on? And we're hedge funds. We're sitting at our desks every day, and there's nobody in Europe. There's nobody in Australia. Like, everybody's just off on holiday, and which is fine, you know, and you should be. And we actually found that they have a robust backup system there because people are forced to go away for weeks at a time. And so, but if you want to trade in July, August, early September, good luck. There's nobody there. So, but it's the same thing here in a way, in that that's when people take off because their kids are off in school and all that. And so you have young executives who are young investors who are taking off, and they're not active as much. And so the volumes are way down. So if you look at Bitcoin, volumes have been really, 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 really light. You know, I mean, there's been nothing that has been shocking. And even though they're really light, the market, the street has just swallowed hundreds of thousands of OG coins that we know of, and that they've just like, and the price didn't really move, you know? I mean, a couple percent, maybe. If you tried to sell 80,000 coins 5 years ago, what do you think would have happened?
I've said it before on the pod. I think that is actually one of the most bullish signals we've had recently, is that 80,000 coins hit the market and basically nothing happened. Like, if you took a kind of US dollar equivalent of that in 2021, like, the market is absolutely tanking. It would, no way it could support that.
Yeah, but it just swallowed them and just kept going, you know, just stayed where it is. And so, you know, and you had some people that were also at the same time, Danny, they're selling Bitcoin to turn around and buy treasury companies, and treasury companies get that capital, but they're not, you know, using it yet, or they're getting capital from private funds like mine or hedge funds like mine, and they're not deploying it yet. They're not buying the Bitcoin yet. So capital's coming out of, and, you know, we physically send Bitcoin to them or whatever. And so that's like, there's either selling of straight Bitcoin or just a pause in buying of it, that and then because of the MNAV situation, if you've got companies that are tapping the MNAV, that tapping the ATM with their market, NAV to Bitcoin over 1.5, and you're taking dollars out to buy these companies that would have otherwise probably just bought Bitcoin. So that's 33% of the capital that's not being used by Bitcoin. So it's been a weird period. But all that said, am I bullish? Yeah. And I'm actually bullish short term too. I mean, now we're in a situation where all eyes are on the Fed. Like every single thing that happens on Wall Street is kind of centering around these economic indicators that are pointing to the Fed having to ease. And so it's priced into the market. 25 basis points is priced in. If you look at Fed funds futures today, you pull them up on Bloomberg, you're looking at it's over 100% probability there's a cut next week.
What you're saying there about like the market volatility, I think is pretty interesting because obviously all the speculators seem to have gone to these treasury companies. And it's like something that I'm more and more convinced on is that Bitcoin isn't volatile enough anymore for these like retail nihilist speculators who just want to get like 1,000x on something. Is that kind of lack of volatility in Bitcoin? Do you think that is like we're at market maturation, at least to a degree now, and we're not going to see the same kind of volatility we've seen in the past?
No, I still think we're going to see periods of volatility, extreme volatility when there's market drawdowns in particular, and then extreme volatility to the upside when there is a reaction to it from central banks. So I still think there's going to be volatility, but just we're in this period of summer doldrums, just quiet. It's just grinding sideways, waiting for something to happen, waiting for something to move. It's been mostly following expansion of global liquidity. This whole time, it just lags by 10 or 12 weeks. Uh-huh. One of the guys that I talked to, and I really respect his work, is Michael Howell of Cross Border Capital, and he writes these pieces. He's got a great Substack. It's expensive, but it's worth it. But he has a proprietary model, Danny, that measures how much liquidity there is. In the globe, around the world. What's important about this is it's not just M2. It's not just the money supply. The M2 is the largest component of it, but it's also just the amount of liquidity that's out there that is attached to things like debt. And so when you have, he has this measurement and it's proprietary, and I don't know exactly what it is, how he calculates it, but it includes things like volatility of bonds, because when bonds are very volatile, then your counterparty requires more. They require more collateral because of the volatility of the bond, and so that means that takes liquidity out of the market. Right, you have less leverage, or lower leverage. So that's one of the things he does. He looks at things like the shadow banking, the private credit and where that is going. So I really do respect his work and follow that, but Bitcoin's been following it closely. Gold's gotten ahead of itself here according to those measures, but Bitcoin has been following it. And I think that we're going to continue to expand liquidity here going into the fall and up to at least the beginning of next year. So I'm not worried. The only thing that concerns me is some sort of black swan event that seems to come every 7 to 10 years, and that the 100-year event that comes every 7 to 10 years now. So
this episode is brought to you by the massive legend Iron, the largest NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin miner using 100% renewable energy. Iron are not just powering the Bitcoin network, they're also providing cutting-edge computing resources for AI, all backed by renewable energy. We've been working with their founders, Dan and Will, for quite some time now, and have been really impressed with their values, especially their commitment to local communities and sustainable computing power. So whether you're interested in mining Bitcoin or harnessing AI compute power, Iron is setting the standard. Visit iron.com to learn more, which is iren.com. If you already self-custody your Bitcoin, you know the deal with hardware wallets. Complex setups, clumsy interfaces, and a seed phrase that can be lost, stolen, or forgotten. Well, BitKey fixes that. BitKey is a multi-sig hardware wallet built by the team behind Square and Cash App. It packs a cryptographic recovery system and built-in inheritance feature into an intuitive, easy-to-use wallet with no seed phrase to sweat over. It's simple, secure self-custody without the stress, and Time named BitKey one of the best inventions of 2024. Get 20% off at bitkey.world when you use code WBD. That's bitkey.world and use code WBD. One of the things that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. This is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, your Bitcoin is insured with your own A-plus rated Lloyd's of London insurance policy, and all Bitcoin is held in their time-locked multi-sig vaults. So you have the peace of mind knowing your Bitcoin is fully insured while not giving up custody. So whether you're worried about inheritance planning, wrench attacks, natural disasters, or just your own mistakes, you're fully protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch today for a quote and for more details about your security options and coverage. Visit anchorwatch.com today. That is anchorwatch.com. Is that like Bitcoin tracking liquidity with a slight lag? Is it sort of 100% hit rate on that?
It's not 100%, but it follows it in an extremely tight correlation, meaning if liquidity goes up steeply, Bitcoin goes up steeply, lagging it by almost 3 months. Comes down, if liquidity is drawn out of the system, it feels it. So it does the same thing. And what's interesting about this is stocks do the same thing, equities, because people use those as places to tuck capital in order to protect it against inflation. You know, they use stocks, they use gold, they use Bitcoin. So it's interesting. It's become one of the best, closest correlated assets to liquidity, global liquidity, over the last couple of years. So,
and what has global liquidity done recently? Is that now expanding again?
It is. It's not rapid, but it's still expanding. But you have these periods. So, if you look at global liquidity and Michael's thesis says that every 6 to 7 years, the global liquidity goes in these cycles, right? 6 or 7 year cycle. We're coming to the end of this expansion of this cycle, which means that, this cycle is supposed to end at the end of this year, beginning of next year. So if you think that global liquidity starts to tighten, if it's being drawn out, then at the beginning of next year, that would give Bitcoin to somewhere in the spring to summer to kind of top out, all things being equal. Does it follow it perfectly? No, of course not. It's Bitcoin. It sometimes wants to march a different way, but it typically does correlate to it over those long stretches.
But are you pretty confident then that the liquidity cycle is going to sort of top out in that kind of time period? Because just on the sort of left end of the bell curve where I like to firmly sit, the thing that seems likely to me is that Trump's going to run things incredibly hot going into sort of midterms, which wouldn't be until this time next year. So could that liquidity cycle actually be elongated as well?
Well, there's only so much he can do, right? But he can pull back on tariffs. He can sign into executive orders, he could sign something into practice with something that would be spending, but it's kind of hard to really change the big budget. I mean, the budget is the budget. He could go on some sort of hiring spree like Biden did through the executive branch, but by and large, of course, he could sign things into legislation like write off all the student loans. Well, that would be pretty inflationary, That's a lot of loans. That's a lot of capital. Or do things with housing. It's true, he could. But there's how much is that lag and all that? I do agree with you, and he will put pressure on the Fed to be accommodative rather than restrictive. And so that is one thing that he has been doing, and he'll continue to do. I believe that, and he'll get some other people around him to join in and pressure the Fed too. But look, he's going to have his third appointee here in pretty soon, and the Fed, you already had in the last meeting, you had two dissents. Two Fed governors dissented the vote, and they wanted to cut rates and the rest of them didn't. Well, now you have three. That was historic. That was already almost unheard of, Danny. You don't have like you get majority yes men on the Fed, you know? And so to have two dissents, that was like, whoa. And so now you're likely to have three. And so it's going to be difficult for you to have three doves on, you know, at least three on the Fed, and Powell is saying, no, we're going to hold strong. We're only going to cut once or whatever, you know? So I do think it's going to continue to expand. Now, your question was, do I think that stops? It just stops. Well, I think it slows down. It trickles out. Remember, all this stuff takes time to play out. So, but I don't know when that is. It's hard to tell. We've got a lot of geopolitical things going on right now, and we do have something different going on. Like you suggested, this last spring all started with the tariffs. It's changed the market a little bit, and people are trying to figure out all these numbers and what they mean and how much impact it's had and is going to continue to have. So,
yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. So this show is actually going to go out on Tuesday next week, which is, I think, the first day of the FOMC meeting.
Okay.
Maybe before we get into what is likely to happen there, we can talk a bit about what happened at Jackson Hole, because I know you wrote a big piece on this and I've not paid that much attention. So explain what Jackson Hole is and then what happened this year.
Yeah. So Jackson Hole is, I'll bring up my, do you have the newsletter?
I do. Yeah. Do you want me to share it?
Yeah. Perfect. Okay. So Jackson Hole, what's Jackson Hole? Well, used to be way back when, it used to be this meeting they had, it started back in the early 80s, where you had the Fed, certain people from the Fed, and then they invited some central bankers and bankers or whatever to this kind of outdoorsy, off the street, you know, like out of DC, out of Wall Street, just kind of sleepy little Jackson Hole, Wyoming town, to just go and have some barbecue and shoot the bull. And it was called the Economic Policy Symposium, right? And it just grew into this behemoth of over the past 40 years, it grew into this behemoth of a meeting. It used to be where you might be able to talk to the Fed governor or chairman and get some off the cuff comments or something a little bit less guarded, you know, but it's turned into this thing where you've got this massive, very special invite list to go out to Jackson Hole and talk about the economy and central banking. And so now it's become something where this last Jackson Hole gathering is Powell's last hurrah, and it's his final chance to give the public, you know, a non-press conference scripted style of send-off to say, I think we did a good job. We've done a good job. We're doing a good job and we're in good shape. And so you kind of expected that from him, right? What people were really hanging on, but now it's become, like I was saying, it's become so closely watched that the comments aren't quite as off the cuff and they're pretty guarded. And so it's very deliberate, everything he says, you know.
So it's basically like an official meeting now.
Yeah, it's basically, there's no podium. I can't remember if there's a podium this year or not, but there's no podium and he's just talking kind of in his Western shirt off the cuff, but it's not off the cuff. Yeah. So, and the issue here this year is going into that, going to Jackson Hole, you had over 80% of people. So Fed funds showed an over 80% chance that we would be getting a rate cut, right? So, and we had that PPI shock that came out, and so they pushed up all the way up to 100% odds because we had benign inflation. Then we had a terrible PPI print that came out. So they went back down to about 80, 85%. But anyways, there's some conflicting data coming through. So people are like, well, what's he going to say? What are they focused on? And so the most likely thing for him to say was that, look, we're we're data dependent, but inflation seems to be in check, and we're kind of turning our attention toward unemployment now, or the employment. So you know this, the Fed has two kind of, they have two mandates, and the first one is stable pricing, which is what they have they've quoted as 2% inflation target. You know, and that's their mandate. And then the second one is full employment, whatever that is. We don't know what that is. It's just, does it feel like it's full? I guess it is, you know. That's the second, is just try to get full employment, whatever that is. So what that really means is that, hey, be ready with the fire hose, with the, you know, the money bazooka, if we see an uptick in a steep rise in unemployment, because that means that we are in a recession. We got to turn it back around. So he came out and basically said, you know, we're data dependent, but we're more focused on inflation, or more focused on the employment side of things right now. And then sure enough, just a few weeks later, we get our confirmation that employment's not that great. It does look like it's rolling over. We revised out 900,000 jobs over the course of 2024 to beginning of 2025. The year ends in March when they're measuring that. And, you know, it was kind of that immediately just said, okay, that's it. We're getting a cut in September, and that's what the market is telling the Fed, telling Powell that's what they expect. And so that's kind of what, after that meeting, it was more or less cemented that, yeah, we're going to get 25 basis points, but not 50. And we're just going to have to see where we are after that. Now it's flash forward to today. And we had a PPI print, meaning prices were not as inflated as people think, which means, the producers can't pass this along. They may be struggling to pass on to the consumer, which means the consumer is getting tired. And then we had kind of a benign CPI print.
Was this in like the August data? Like, I think PPI was disinflationary. It was like minus 0.01%. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And then turned around this month, and it was. So if you look at just a couple of days ago, I'll see if I can pull it up here. The PPI from, let's see, I think it was on Tuesday, maybe, or Wednesday. So they were expecting 0.3%, and it came in at negative 0.1%. So that's the one that you're quoting. And then they're expecting 3.3% on total year over year, and it came at 2.6%. So people are like, oh man, that means that they're not able to pass it on. That means CPI is probably not going to be that bad. And it wasn't, you know, it's not great. And it's still inflation, it's still 3% inflation, but it's not bad enough. It gives the Fed enough cover to go ahead and cut 25 basis points. So that's where kind of the market is now.
So the market's at 25 basis point cut rather than 50 as of right now.
Right. So that's what I was starting to say before, is that right now there's 110% chance that there's a cut this next week. So what does that mean? That means that there's a 10% chance that there's a 50 basis point cut, right? So one cut is 25 basis points. So that means that there's like a 10%, if it's 110% chance, it's a 10% chance there's a 50 basis point cut. Not going to happen. I just don't see that. Unless there's an emergency that happens this weekend, but there's nothing. So we got the unemployment numbers. We've got what we've got. They know what they know, and that's going to be a 25 basis point cut. So now all eyes are on the Fed, Danny. Why? Because you also have an 88% chance that there's a cut in October, and a 92% chance there's a cut in December. So people are basically expecting three cuts between now and the end of the year. So what people are going to do now, and here's the important thing for next week's meeting, is you're going to hear Powell. He's going to say, we feel inflation's under control. We're headed toward our 2% target. We're not. We're between 2 and 3%. We're going to stay there, I think. And then the second side, he's going to say, but we, you know, employment is it appears the jobs market is softening, you know, slightly or something, you know, and so they're going to get ahead of that and they're going to cut. And then he's going to say, but we're data dependent and we're going to wait for more information to come in to decide what the policy is going forward. We're not going to commit to a series of cuts. We're just not going to commit to it. Because what happens, Danny, like, here's the issue. And this is why all eyes are on the Fed. And now we have a situation where you've got people saying, well, there's going to be 3 cuts to the end of the year. There's going to be 4 or 5 cuts. You know, like, people are kind of a little bit in between there. But the issue is that what does the Fed do now? Because inflation is still... prices are still rising. We still have inflation. Well, you know, Danny, we have year over year, the CPI number, the number they use, which we know is problematic, but this is what they're looking at. It's still 2.9%. That's not 2%. And, you know, this has been actually, if you look back, it bottomed out and it's been rising since earlier this year. So, now it's back up from, you know, 2.4% or 2.3 to 2.4% up to back up to 2.9%. It's the wrong direction, you know? Mm-hmm. So you can't say that it is headed the right direction. It's actually headed the wrong direction, but he'll say it feels like it's under control or it's in a range that they're comfortable with or whatever. They're just turning their attention to unemployment. But here's the issue. So people are like, okay, that's great. So now we've got prices still rising, the jobs market is softening, and you guys are so far behind the ball that what the heck is 25 basis points going to do to help the jobs market? It's not. They know that. We know that. But what the 25 basis point cut will do pretty quickly is it will loosen up credit. Make it a little bit easier to get some credit. And so that's actually inflationary. Now, I believe that we're above the neutral rate still. So it's not yet accommodative. I think you're still tightening, but there are structural issues here with inflation. There could be a lot of reasons behind it and around it, which part of it likely tariffs and how much is being passed on to consumers and how much that's affecting pricing. That's likely part of it. And how many effects it has? Is it just a one-time thing? No, not really. It will have echo effects on it that we're not sure about. But that's one thing. But, you know, you've got these high interest rates on money market accounts that boomers are sitting on and they're just spending like mad. So if you look at the consumer as a whole, you've got the Fed saying the consumer's still strong. Yeah, maybe if you look at 100% of them, but if you take out the top 10%, how strong is the consumer really? We don't know. What we do know is that credit card delinquencies are now at 12.3%. I'm sorry, 90-day delinquencies are up to 12.3%. So people who have not paid their credit card bill for 90 days, they're just about... You know, they're less than 1% away from where the peak of the Great Financial Crisis. Damn, of 13.1%. That is a red flag.
I read the newsletter you did on this, and I saw that the consumer debt is now at like 18.5 trillion or something like that, which is absolutely insane. But what would like a normal delinquency like rate be? Because I've no idea about that.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at the, you know, a typical period that we're not really rising or falling, or we're just kind of, you know, we're kind of just clunking along. I mean, it should be somewhere around 5 to 7% ish, you know, for credit cards. Because typically the people who use credit cards are lower income and they're using it to bridge a gap of spending and it catches up to them because, you know, these rates can be 20, 25, 30%, 29.95%, you know, and it kills you. It really destroys you as an individual or consumer. So, but here's the crazy thing, Danny, as that credit card debt is that 90-day delinquency is rising up toward, and okay, two things. Number one, these are numbers from the New York Fed, but they're from the end of June. Like, we're already lagging. This is second quarter number, right? So we're already lagging, you know, where we are here. So that's number one. Number two, this also has that student loan delinquencies are up over 10%. So who's not paying student loans? The young people, lower demographic likely, who already have credit card debt. So how bad would the credit card delinquencies be if they were paying their loans? But these people are just taking a sabbatical on them. They're like, no, the government's not going to make me pay this off. I'm going to get this for free. I'm not going to pay this. So what happens if they are forced to pay them, or they start going bankrupt? Well, they're going to write off their credit card debt. There will be some casualties there. So that's what I'm looking at. And really what this says is, it doesn't say that the whole demographic, the whole economy is bad. This is saying that there are people down there in the lower demographic who are really struggling.
Bitcoin is absolutely ripping, and in every bull market, there's always a new wave of investors, and with it, a flood of new companies, new products, and new promises. But if you've been around long enough, you've seen how this story ends for a lot of them. Some cut corners, take risks with your money, or just disappear. That's why when it comes to buying Bitcoin, the only exchange I recommend is River. They deeply care about doing things right for their clients and are built to last with security and transparency at their core. With River, you have peace of mind knowing all their Bitcoin is held in multi-sig cold storage, and it's the only Bitcoin-only exchange in the US with proof of reserves. There really is no better place to buy Bitcoin, so to open an account today, head over to river.com/WBD and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy. That's river.com/WBD. What if you could lower your tax bill and stack Bitcoin at the same time? Well, by mining Bitcoin with Blockware, you can. New tax guidelines from the Big Beautiful Bill allow American miners to write off 100% of the cost of their mining hardware in a single tax year. That's right, 100% write-off. If you have 100K in capital gains or income, you can purchase 100K of miners and offset it entirely. Blockware's mining as a service enables you to start mining Bitcoin right now without lifting a finger. Blockware handles everything from securing the miners to sourcing low-cost power to configuring the mining pool. They do it all. You get to stack Bitcoin at a discount every single day while also saving big come tax season. Get started today by going to mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD, and for every hosted miner purchased, you get 1 week of free hosting and electricity. Of course, none of this is tax advice. Speak with Blockware to learn more at mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD. Do you wish you could access cash without selling your Bitcoin? Well, Ledin makes that possible. Ledin are the global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending, and since 2018, they've issued over $9 billion in loans with a perfect record of protecting client assets. With Ledin, you get full custody loans with no credit checks, no monthly repayments, just easy access to dollars without selling a single sat. As of July 1st, Ledin is Bitcoin only, meaning they exclusively offer Bitcoin-backed loans with all collateral held by Ledin directly or their funding partners. Your Bitcoin is never lent out to generate interest. I recently took out a loan with Ledin, and the whole process couldn't have been easier. It took me less than 15 minutes to go through the application, and in just a few hours, I had the dollars in my account. It was super smooth. So if you need cash but you don't want to sell Bitcoin, head over to ledin.io/WBD and you'll get 0.25% off your first loan. That's ledin.io/WBD. Yeah, it's crazy that they can say with a straight face that the sort of the consumer market is doing well, because all you have to do is spend 5 minutes talking to people and you know that's not the case. Yeah. Like, people are really struggling.
Yeah.
And is the problem they're kind of faced with here that if they do cut rates, it doesn't actually make any meaningful difference to the people, like to jobs and things like that, and instead it does just cause asset prices to pump and then inflation quite quickly?
Well, I mean, our economy is very financialized, right? So you've got to it. And so now, so we're getting into the crux of it. So we're in a period now that appears that we're sliding into stagflation. We don't know for sure, but it appears that that's where we're headed. And where you have rising prices and you've got a softening economy, you've got a softening job market. And that is just an absolutely awful position to be in as an economy. And as you know, the Fed, like, what can they do? If they lower interest rates dramatically, well, that could create more upward pricing pressure and rising prices and more inflation. And it could lag so much, it doesn't really help the job market yet. So then you have even worsening price where you've got rising prices, softening job market, and everything is, that's a really difficult position for the middle class in particular to be in, middle and lower demographics. So we get back in the 80s. I mean, the 80s were awful. I mean, I lived through it. It was brutal. We had to wait in line for 3 hours to get one tank of gas every 2 weeks because, if your license plate ended in an odd number, then this is your week. And even though next week is your week. And so it was tough, we felt the pinch hard, and we were, we weren't wealthy, so we felt it. So that's a terrible position for the Fed to be in. So why do we see what is going on in the market? And that's why you've got gold ripping to new highs and asset prices like stocks and Bitcoin bumbling around or creating new highs. And so, or bumbling around new highs or creating new highs. And so you've got two different things going on. This is abnormal to see stocks ripping to new highs and gold ripping to new highs at the same time. But it's telling you that there's a strong worry about inflation and stagflation. And at the same time that stocks are saying, we're going to see liquidity here. We're going to see expansion of liquidity and everything's okay, at least for now. So it's kind of a weird place for everybody to be. And that's why everybody is watching the Fed so closely. They're trying to figure out what does this mean?
So like regardless of what Powell may do, because we know he's been pretty hawkish for a long time now. Is there anything the Fed could do to try and get this under control? Or is this just a sort of nothing stop this train narrative and they're stuck between a rock and a hard place?
They're really stuck. I mean, okay, so what else could you do? They've got two levers plus quasi levers, which are acronyms. They've got two levers. They get interest rates. You can raise or lower the target rate, a Fed funds overnight rate, which kind of keys at least the low end, the short end of the curve. They've lost the long end, or they never really had control of it. So it's not really fair to say they lost it. I mean, the long end is the long end. It bakes in a lot of expectations of long-term inflation or economic uncertainty. And so it's hard to tell where that long end, it's hard for the Fed to do anything about the long end, except when they start doing QE and QT, where they can be buying and selling the long end of the curve to kind of keep it in a range if they wanted to, which is something called yield curve control. But they're in a tough spot here, Danny, because, okay, so what do they do? Lower rates, you could have more inflation. Don't lower rates, keep doing QT, and you could have the job market fall apart. Well, we have heard Powell say before that he's more comfortable with that set of problems than the other set, which is what Volcker had to come in and deal with back in the 80s. And you've heard, basically you've heard Powell trying to invoke Volcker to say, I'm going to be like him. I'm not going to be like Burns. I'm not going to let this inflation run out of control. I'm going to keep a lid on it, even if it means that the job market suffers from it. And we have some casualties there with the job, with unemployment. Why is he okay with that? He's okay with that because he knows he could turn around and flood the market with capital and short back up. And they would rather have a situation where they don't let inflation get out of control, rage out of control, which that would create a problem with the borrowing, the amount of interest they have to pay on borrowing, because they're, the government is running on a $2 trillion deficit. They still have to borrow. And so unless they have inflation run to insane levels, they're still going to run in deficit. So they can't let it get out of control. So what's the other side of that? Well, you could do QT or QE. Well, what happens, Danny, if they start printing money and buying bonds in the open market again?
Is there any talk of that? Is that even likely? Because I don't hear much about that.
No, there's no talk of it yet. But here's the point is that it's very difficult, but he's more comfortable. He said they have tools to deal with that. There's the exact quote. We have tools to deal with that, meaning we could just flood the market with capital like we've done before, like we did in the great financial crisis, like we did in 2021, 22, you know. They're more comfortable with that because in the long run, just allowing for the expansion of the money supply or pushing for more expansion of the money supply, not just out of creation of debt through banks, but actually going out there and printing money and buying bonds in the open market, that in and of itself means that you debase a currency and you make it easier to pay back old debt. Like, it's a playbook. It's what they want to do. The question is, how hot will they let inflation run? That's the only question that's in my mind. They're going to have to let it run. Just how hot? We don't know.
If you had to speculate on that, what would you guess? Like, do you think anything under sort of 5% they'll be okay with?
Anything under 4%, I think they're going to be okay with. They start getting really nervous. If it ticks up here 3.5, 3.7, they're going to get nervous. But no, I mean, I do think, Danny, that we will get into a situation where the economy will grind lower. And whether we have, it's when do we have the next event? Like, what is the next Silicon Valley Bank? When is the next, you know, Ukraine that bleeds out into a larger global crisis? When is the next, you know, market shock for something that we can't even dream of, because that's why it's called a black swan? So that's the question. And when that happens, they're not going to just print another 4 or 5 trillion. They're going to be printing, you know, 7, 8, 10, 12 trillion, in my opinion, to shore it up, because the leverage is that much larger now. It's that we are so indebted. We have $324 trillion of debt out there. The entire world is debt indebted. So that denominator has just created a problem. And so you're going to have to print more. And when you do print more, that just means higher inflation. So what are they going to be comfortable with? I think under 4%, they would likely be comfortable with. They wouldn't panic, but they're going to create where we're not going to have 9% inflation. We might have 12, 15, 18% inflation for a period of time. It's going to be, and it's going to take some, it's going to be very painful for some people. So
is there a really like weird, perverse incentive here where they're kind of desperate for the next black swan to give them an excuse to do something more drastic?
I'm not that cynical, so I hope not.
I'm not saying they create it, but like, are they looking for an opportunity to do something more drastic?
Well, I mean, look, we know the incentive of our leaders is to get reelected. It's a structural problem in Congress that we have no term limits, Danny. So their only incentive truly is to get reelected. And that means mm-hmm. to toe the party line, get the party support, and all shore each other up. Whatever that party line is, they got to say it in order to, you know, get reelected, which is extremely polarizing in this country. But they'll do that. And so that's their incentive. That means that they're not going to cut spending for their demographic. And it also means that they're likely not going to raise taxes on their demographic. So those are two solutions that are pretty much taken off the table. They try to trick each other into doing those things, but they don't do it. So those are two solutions to the debt problem taken off the table. The third solution is just allow for inflation and not worry about it. Just make sure that it's not so bad that people are up in arms over it. You know, they don't want people revolting over it. So that's the true incentive. So when you ask, do they want something? Well, I think what the Treasury wants is for Congress to figure out how to rein in spending somehow. That's why they keep putting out pieces that are like, hey, look, we can't keep doing this. This is unsustainable, but good luck. I just described why the incentives are wrong. It's not going to happen. So, So here's the issue and why they don't want to have something catastrophic, because when you have something catastrophic, your deficit blows out and it could be multiples of what it was. If you just do the simple math, We spend $7 trillion. Most of that we're spending on programs that are signed into legislation. They're mandatory spending, right? So Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and then you've got defense spending, which is not going to get cut, and you've got your debt. You have to pay the interest rate on your debt, and that's over $1 trillion now. So when you add those up, you know, you're already at over $5 trillion. You're over $5.5 or $6 trillion. So even if you cut out all the other spending,
it doesn't leave much left.
Yeah. But when you do go into a steep drawdown, because we're so financialized and because you see jobs just get, you know, the jobs fall off a cliff when you have some sort of black swan driven event that I don't even know if we could say the housing crisis is a black swan, because a lot of people saw it. Most people ignored it. But when you have something like that happen, you fall into a great recession like that. Well, what happens to your denominator and your numerator? So you've got, first of all, you've got your spending. That $7 trillion could go up by somewhere between 10 and 20%. If it's really bad, say it's 20%. Well, now you're spending $8.4 trillion. And then you turn around and on the revenue side for Congress, or for the Treasury, is $5 trillion. Well, you could have a 10 or 20% drawdown there. So let's say it's 20% and you get $4 trillion. Well, now your deficit is, you know, what did we just say? 8.4 minus 5. You're at $3.4 trillion. You've almost doubled your deficit on a drawdown. So they can't really have that. Because now you're spending, you're borrowing over $3 trillion a year, which we're already spending over two, you know, and those numbers could easily get out of hand really quickly. Mm-hmm. And so they can't really have that. And that's why they turn around the money bazooka and they try to stop that as quickly as they can. So do I think that they secretly cheered on? No, because of that one issue right there. Even a V drawdown, it is painful. And so they got to hurry up and get money out there in order to monetize their own debt and make sure that you get more money out into the market and keep the charade going, keep the Ponzi going.
I mean, it's insane. Is there almost like a gravity to close to 0% interest rates here that they're constantly trying to fight? Because it seems like all they have left is really to cut rates. Do you think we'll see sort of close to 0% interest rates again in like the midterm, like the next 5 years?
In the next 5 years, yeah, I could see us going all the way back down to 1% or so. I could see that. It depends on the economy and just how deflationary things like AI start becoming and how many jobs are rearranged, you know.
But their incentive, like especially when you talk about the interest on their debt payment as part of the budget, like they need to get that as low as possible.
Well, you heard Scott Bessent last year just absolutely hammering Janet Yellen about not terming out the debt, which meant that, and he was like, you had your chance to term out the debt and you didn't do it. Okay, what does he mean by that? Well, so she was the chair of the Fed once. So she knew exactly what was going on when they printed that $5 trillion. Like she knew exactly what would happen, that there would be inflation, that they would have to raise rates, and that would cause a problem for the Treasury. Yet she didn't term out the debt. She kept issuing the same levels all along. She could have been issuing longer term debt at much lower rates, but she didn't do it. And so then Scott saw that the Fed lowered rates by 50 basis points. He's like, oh, here we go. I'm going to be able to get my debt termed out pretty quickly here. And so he started really hammering her and saying, we're going to solve this problem. We're going to be the ones to solve this problem. And he came in, and nothing against Scott, you know, like this is just the reality of it. The Fed was like, nope, we're done cutting rates. Now that Trump's in office, let's see what happens. We think that these tariffs are going to be inflationary, so we got to hold off and see what happens. Well, they should have been cutting rates. If you're looking at the jobs numbers, they should have been cutting rates this past summer, June and July. You know, they should have been cutting rates there, but they didn't. And here they are. So, he didn't get his chance and he's been frustrated. They've all been frustrated. They want the Fed to start lowering rates to do exactly what you said. But here's the issue, Danny. Like I said, they're not setting the 10-year. What happened when they cut rates by 50 basis points back in the fall of 2024? Well, they cut by 50 basis points and the 10-year yield went up by 50 basis points. It went the opposite direction. Why did it do that? Because the market knew that it was kind of a political move here for them to say, yes, we conquered inflation, you know, all's good right before the election. I mean, it was ridiculous. Let's just call it what it is. And then to just stop, you don't do that. You don't just cut 50 basis points and stop. That's not what you do. You cut 25 and wait. You cut 50 basis points quickly because you're going to cut another 50 and then 25 right after that really quick. You're going to be really ratcheting down. They didn't do that. So it was an odd move. If you go back in time and look at the way the Fed makes their moves, it was odd. So, that was... The Fed then turned around and said, no, we're going to wait and see if these tariffs are inflationary. We're going to be data dependent here. Well, now they've got themselves really painted, you know, into a corner. So we'll see what happens. But they should have been cutting already. But the problem is, I think they're really scared about that inflation. We saw it get up to over 9% that they admitted to.
Yeah. And realistically, it was probably 15 or more.
Well, I can tell you they tried to double my auto insurance this year just because they just tried to. And I was like, I had no speeding tickets, no accidents. I mean, perfect record. I'm a middle-aged male driver, which I'm like, I'm the right demographic here. And you're trying to double my rates? Like, this is just insane, you know? So in 1 year. So it's kind of crazy.
One of the really interesting things that Scott Bessent came out and said, I don't know, this was probably 3 or 4 days ago now, was he blamed the Fed on the wealth inequality in the US. And again, like, as Bitcoin, is this something people have been talking about for a long time? Like, we know this. But it was interesting to hear him come out and say it. Do you think that was kind of just political posturing because, again, they just want to ratchet up the pressure on Jerome Powell? Or do you think there is a meaningful, like, demand for change there?
There's a truth to it. There is a truth to it. I don't know. I don't know Scott well enough. I don't know him personally to know what his real intentions are on changing the nature of the Fed. But, he's a Wall Street guy. He knows exactly what's been going on. He's seen it all his career. He is right. And so whether or not he's trying to really change it, he's right. The Fed manipulating the money supply, manipulating access to capital has absolutely caused what's called the Cantillon effect, you know? And so, and that comes from this economist Cantillon who figured out that those who are closest to the money spigot benefit the most. And so who is that? Those are JP Morgan's and hedge funds of the world, you know, and they really benefit from this. So that, and the people who have capital, the wealthier demographic who have capital that are with those banks, that are, assets, they have assets, that's right, too, and investments that are with those large banks, that are with the Fidelities, that they're, you know, they're benefiting from that expansion of the money supply because it goes into their assets and it goes, right to their bottom line. So
is super interesting. The probably one question that I would have to ask is, like, this whole conversation really has been about the Fed. Do the Fed even matter anymore in any meaningful way, or is it just a signal to the market?
Oh, no, sure, they matter. Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, they matter way too much. You know, they control the overnight lending rate that all these banks are tied to. So that creates a situation where we don't have much capital in the reverse repo anymore. It's actually drained, but it does, it causes the cost of capital to go up for everything. That's one thing. And then actually flooding the market with money or siphoning it out, you're manipulating the money supply. It's like you're going into the middle of it. We're all playing Monopoly. We're all on the board. And, you know, if you already own most of the hotels and I don't own any, and you all of a sudden you flood the you flood the market with money, meaning you put more money in the bank, it's just going to benefit you, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you're just printing more monopoly money. But you take it out, it's going to, you know, that's the thing. It's like you're injecting and taking out money in this game, and it affects different people, different players in a different way. If you have assets, it's great. If you don't, you're toast. It just causes rises of pricing, rising in prices, and then you don't have the money to keep up. And the problem with the lower demographic, right, is that every incremental rise in everyday goods is painful for them, because the vast majority of their paycheck is going to those things. It's going to rent and gas and food, you know? And so, and energy, their air conditioning, if they're in a hot climate, or their heating, if they're in a cold climate, and that it's painful for them, because it means they have no discretionary income to go do anything else or to invest. And so when you have the wealthy demographic is like, oh man, the gas is now $4 at the pump, and it used to be $2.50. They're not thinking that. They don't even look at it. They just pump the gas. They don't look at what the price is. They don't look at their grocery bills that closely. They're like, I don't know. Maybe I spend $1,000 or $2,000 a month on groceries. I don't know. They literally, they just are, it doesn't affect their everyday. And it really doesn't affect it enough to impact the amount that they're investing or have invested. So that's the problem, is that here's where Scott Bessent is, and this is where Trump's mind is, I believe, is that he needs the Fed to lower rates soon. He wants them to lower rates soon and to get out of the QT business, to ease up access to capital, because they're worried it's going to start hitting the middle income demographics, so middle class, and which there's not a big, like, middle class has been hurt really badly here. But if it starts bleeding into middle class, that really hurts a majority of the economy. And so you can't depend on that top 10% anymore to keep going. And so that's kind of the issue. And that's what they're concerned about.
Is it not already hitting the middle class though? It feels like, I don't know for how long, but for the last 5 years, maybe post-COVID, probably before, like, the middle class have been in a really tough spot.
They've been squeezed. Yeah, absolutely. They've been squeezed. So how it has hurt them is that they haven't been able to invest in as much, you know, put as much capital away. And so that's how it is. It's hurt them, made them tread water. You know, that's what I see with my middle class friends who just feel like they're treading water. They're two income families. All their money goes toward their rent or their mortgage and their groceries. And that's the problem, is they're treading water. So it has hurt them. But the lower demographic is really struggling. That's where you're seeing the delinquencies in the credit cards, the complete sabbatical on paying their student debt, you know? So that's definitely the first red flag.
There's a quote in Gigi's book, which is taken from Alice in Wonderland. And it's, I think it's the Red Queen or someone like that, who says, here you have to run as fast as you can just to stay in place. And if you want to go anywhere, you have to run twice as fast as that. And it is like the perfect analogy to this fiat Ponzi financial system that we live in.
This is why you have these two camps here. You've got gold running to all-time highs, and you've got central banks buying gold. They're not buying U.S. treasuries. That is a structural problem. And we're recognizing that, which is why the stablecoin bill is so important, to get the ability to tuck in liquidity spots where we, you know, little pools of liquidity that the treasury doesn't currently have access to, or has access only through something like Tether, but that, you know, they want more. So, that's an issue. So you've got gold ripping at all-time highs. And then on the other side, you've got the markets waiting to see what happens with the Fed. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of what everybody's focused on. But also, I'm looking at things like, if you look at credit spreads, you know, from corporate treasuries to the 10-year, they're low, you know, there's not a lot of angst there. If you look at, term premiums on the 10 year, they moved up to over 85 basis points. They're all the way back to 60 today because people are calming down a little bit about the worry about a ripping inflation. They're calmed down about that, you know? So you look at these things and then you look at the VIX, and the VIX is, I mean, it's down around, today is at 1471. I mean, it's bouncing around the bottom here because there's a lot of either complacency or confidence that we've got, you know, we've got more runway. And so to bring the whole Fed conversation to the end here about the Fed is, when the Fed cuts rates, typically they're way behind the eight ball and they cut too late and we're already in recession and you see the markets draw down steeply. But every once in a while, they cut while the market is modestly expanding and just it's starting to grind sideways, though, and they get it right. And so that's positive for risk assets, for things like gold and Bitcoin too, because it's expansionary and you and that expands liquidity. And then sometimes they'll cut when it's too early and it rips higher. We saw it in the 80s. But I think that we're right now in the period that they could start cutting and it's not dire yet. And if they do stay on a program of cutting, it'll keep this thing going for a while. But that's why everybody's eyes are on the Fed, to try to figure out what they're going to do next. And if it's going to continue, if they're going to continue on this program, or if they're going to hit pause and stay back and say, remain political and say, we're going to see what the data says.
One of my favorite things about Bitcoin, so this show is going to go out the first morning of the FOMC meeting, but you don't even need to watch it. All you need to do is look at the price of Bitcoin and you know what's happened. Like, Bitcoin's gone up $5,000 in the last like 3 days or something.
They're cutting.
We already know. Yeah. Like, we know what's coming. That's a real free market dynamic that I love. All right, cool. This has been great. I assume off the back of this meeting, you think that's insanely bullish for Bitcoin if they start cutting rates again. What do you think? Like, the rest of this year will look like for Bitcoin?
Look, I've thought that we could hit 150, 180 sometime this fall for a long time. I'm kind of surprised how hard we bounced off that 120, 125 level a few times here. And so, does that give me pause? No. Do I think that the 4-year cycle is over, and bring it all the way back full circle to your question about Bitcoin in the beginning? I mean, I think it's changing. And one of the things that we didn't talk about is because of just the sheer amount of institutional capital that's coming into the space. And what happens is, when you get institutions that decide that they need an allocation to this thing, they start rebalancing their portfolios around it. And so if they want a 1%, 2%, or 3% position in Bitcoin, if Bitcoin goes down, they buy some more. If it goes way up, they sell some, because they want to keep it at that 3% position. And that does dampen volatility. And that's going to continue to happen more and more and more as Bitcoin is continued to be adopted by institutions. And so, but I still think that we have, look, Bitcoin, it can be extremely volatile to the upside too. And so people sometimes forget, all they see is those 50, 60, 70, 80% drawdowns. They're like, oh my God, this thing is volatile to the downside. Remember, it rips higher too. And I don't know if it's true this year yet, but over the last number of years, or since the beginning, you had like almost 90% of your returns in Bitcoin could be captured in just 10 trading days a year. Mm-hmm. It really has violent moves higher. So that's an interesting thing to remember too. So, I still think that we can get 130. If we don't hit 130, I will be shocked. But I still think we can hit 150, 180 by the year end. You know, it wouldn't surprise me in the least. I don't really love price predictions, no, but you know, I'm super confident.
That seems relatively, that doesn't seem too outlandish. Like, I could totally believe that happens as well. It's funny, that stat on like you can capture all the gains in sort of 10 trading days a year. I do wonder how this cycle is changing that, because this has just been a grind. Like, it hasn't been like previous cycles.
We haven't had that blow off top, like you said. We just haven't had it.
It's almost not been a bull market yet. I'm ready, James. But this has been great. Thank you, man. I always love talking to you. Anyway, you want to send anyone before we close out?
No, I appreciate it, Danny. Just remind people that the co-managing partner of the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, and we are investing in the space. So if you're an institutional investor and you want to learn more about it, just come to bitcoinopportunity.fund and reach out, and we can set up a call or something and see if the fund would be right for you. And of course, I write the newsletter, The Informationist, like you were talking about, and that's just at jameslavish.com. There's a free version that you can get each month, and it just simplifies one complicated financial topic every single week. So yeah.
And if you can part with the sats, buy it, because it's one of the best newsletters in the space. James, thank you, man. This has been good. I appreciate you.
It's always good to be here, Danny, and look forward to this fall. It's going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. I'm sure we'll speak soon. Thanks, James.
All right, man.